Colonel Beaver, Reel 4.
I think I made a mistake in one respect, that I took the lease of this office in my own name. It would have been better from the point of view of security if I had taken it in the name, either a fictitious name or in the name of a member of some other embassy, which would have caused a lot of trouble but would have preserved my own purity. Anyway, I never knew who the man was who my embassy colleague wanted to interview. But I did hear afterwards that he was arrested for some reason, and when arrested, and asked if he'd contacted any foreign or any British representative, and he mentioned that he had had a meeting with a British person. I don't even know whether he said a British diplomat, at this particular office. And when they looked up the records, they found that the office was in the name of J.G. Beaver. And this fact was clearly communicated to Salazar, and there came a time, not long after, when he asked to see the ambassador, Sir Ronald Campbell, and said, I regret to have to tell you that I'm informed by my police that a member of your staff with diplomatic privilege is engaged in interviewing some of my people and discussing with them various matters which ought to be reserved for discussions between my government and you. And Sir Ronald Campbell, who was a rather nervous man, was appalled at this disclosure, and said, I find it very hard to believe that such a thing could happen. We are on such good terms, naturally I can't tell you any more about that interview except what the ambassador himself told me on the following day, that he was clearly shaken. He thought that I had been doing something which in fact I had not, and I didn't realize till afterwards what had happened, that it was not J.G. Beaver, but another man whose name doesn't now matter, and he wasn't one of my people. Nor was he an SOE man. He was an SIS man, whom I had tried to help by lending him an office where he could interview somebody. And the ambassador said, my relations with Dr. Salazar are absolutely vital to the whole relation between our governments. And he is interested in all sorts of subjects which are not my subjects, such as sardines, and he's often asking questions to which I cannot possibly know the answer. I do not wish our relations to be confused and exacerbated by an incident like this.
So were you disciplined in any way by Campbell because of this?
I was threatened by his head of Chancery, Paul Mason, that they might have to waive my diplomatic immunity and hand me over to the Portuguese. I said, I suggest you consult the Foreign Office before you take that step, because I knew the Chiefs of Staff would say, but God's sake, no, we can't have the Foreign Office mucking up our war effort in this way. And no, but he was... It didn't need saying that it was such a serious situation that he thought had been caused by me, that it hadn't, that he wouldn't willingly keep me on his staff. I decided that I was doing... He was confused about what had really happened. He was in an extremely nervous condition, and I must do something to help him, to get Salazar's mind into the right focus. And so I did two things, which I'm glad to say were a success. First, I wrote an account in a carefully edited form for the ambassador to give to Salazar, saying, from Major J.G.B., assistant military attaché, and saying why I was under orders to do the things which I had been doing. I said, when I left London, half the city of London was in flames. It was generally believed that the Germans would be invading Spain and Portugal in the spring of 1960, which mercifully has not yet happened. And my main job was, bearing in mind what had happened in the case of France, that we should be able to help the Portuguese government if they were overwhelmed by the force of the Nazis, if we should be able to help them to organize resistance or destroy important installations. But in everything that I was instructed to do and everything that I have done in the year I've been in Portugal was directed to this one end. And I have not distributed money or arms or anything to anybody. And anyway.
So that was one thing you did. What was the second thing you did?
The second, I can't say the second thing was much harder, and I never thought I should succeed, because I couldn't do it myself. I relied on the Secret Intelligence Service to give me something, no, that they would give it direct to the ambassador, showing that the Germans were doing far worse things than anything that I was doing. And of course, the SIS is a very discreet organization and hates ever telling anybody anything. And I was very doubtful if I'd succeed in getting it. Fortunately, the two people who headed the two different branches were both good friends of mine. One was the man to whom I gave this information from Terestrenko, which I told you about earlier, and the other was the man called Philip Johns, who also wrote a book on this subject. You might like to make a note of it. He paid a great tribute to Mary as his secretary. And anyhow, the two of them, thank goodness, were prepared to play and to to disclose some obviously secret information, going so far as to disclose to Salazar that the Germans had been able to repeat a conversation which he had had in his own foreign office with his own foreign secretary. Now this, of course, was the most difficult thing of all to extract, because if you thought it through, it could only have been obtained by disclosing the fact that we had broken the German code and we had intercepted the message from the German embassy to Berlin. And that was the hardest thing to do in wartime. And I was really astonished at this. But this shook him. And he kept these two papers, which the ambassador gave him, for about 2 weeks. And all of us were getting very anxious that something awful was going to happen. But eventually, he handed them back to the ambassador and said, I find Major Beaver's paper sincero y leal, sincere and loyal. I'm inclined to withdraw. I'm inclined to cancel my request for his withdrawal. I think it is better that he should leave Lisbon, but I leave it entirely to you to decide on the timing. Now, this was what I above all needed. I wanted somebody who would take over from me. And so in the end, it was a happy ending. The ambassador, I don't think, ever really quite understood. And I don't think he ever really believed that I could have been as innocent as I said I was. But I think what I said was pretty truthful. And then, of course, this you see, I left in June 1942, and the North African landings were in November 42, which was only 4 or 5 months later. And from that moment, yes, and you see, Pearl Harbor was December 41, I think.
Yes.
And so... I mean, Salazar, from the beginning of 1942, was beginning to realize that it was conceivable that Britain would win the war after all, and that he had been wrong in thinking that we had no chance of ever surviving.
So this incident over the room, over the office, happened in 42.
I'm not sure that I can. The episode of my lending the office to a colleague must have happened about March 1942, and some 3 months must have elapsed. After that episode and the date of my leaving Lisbon, during that period I had been able to arrange for a successor to come and take my place in the embassy.
By this time, was it pretty obvious that the nature of your work had changed because there wasn't going to be a German invasion after all?
It's very interesting you should say that. I returned to London in September 1941 in order to get a new directive. I said the directive I was given in December 1940, before I first went to Lisbon, is now clearly out of date. He, Hitler, instead of crossing the Pyrenees, he's gone southeast into the Balkans, and he may well... September 42, and later still, he has invaded Russia. And I can't see that there is any merit in my continuing to do in Portugal the things I was told to be ready to do when I first joined SOE. There are more important things to be done in Lisbon. All the North African, the work I'm doing on the North African landings, the work I'm doing with the Allies, and all sorts of other things that may arise in the future. All this is being prejudiced by doing in a neutral country, which is historically our oldest ally, things which may produce results which is hard to predict. And I went to the Foreign Office, I talked to the joint planners who advised the chiefs of staff and these things, and of course I talked to the top people in SOE. And they all said in more or less the same words, well, yes, you can see your point, and you're quite right to raise it, but it's perfectly possible that he may be in Moscow by Christmas, and if he does that, and he's knocked the Soviet out of the war, he'll be back in the peninsula in 1942. And I remember the Foreign Office man I spoke to, one of the most intelligent and very well-known diplomatic figure, Frank Roberts. And he was one, I remember using those very words.
So, because of the poor showing of the Russians against the Germans, they still wanted you to continue with your original brief?
Yes. They finished up by saying, so, do please go on doing the carrying out the same directives you were originally given, but be very careful and discreet. I said, what do you think I'm doing now? I can't be more discreet. And sooner or later, anybody doing anything as delicate as this is going to get caught out, and then there's going to be trouble.
You've talked about the way in which SIS helped you with the business of what the Germans were doing.
Yeah.
But what were your relations, generally speaking, with the SIS in Lisbon?
Well, They really were exceptionally good for reasons which themselves are exceptional. When I first went there, the man who was in charge of the whole of their intelligence work in Lisbon, which included the long-range work in Europe. I mean, he was a specialist actually at double agents, and he used to run agents to Berlin and things like that. Later on, he had a nervous breakdown, and was succeeded by this other man whose name I just mentioned, Philip Johns, who's still a friend of mine. The other man's dead. Philip is a man in his mid-80s and with a naval background. Before Philip Johns arrived, they decided in London, rightly, on a thing called, which was always known as Section 5, when the security services in London are dealing with, let us say, a given piece of enemy action which is inimical to this country, it really involves both MI5, which deals with home security, and MI6, which deals with overseas intelligence. They were, after all, so if something's going to happen in this kind of country, it affects MI5. If it's going to be done by somebody who comes, let's say, from Germany, it affects MI6. And somebody had the bright idea that there ought to be a joint section, which was always known as Section 5, which was jointly controlled and operated by MI5 and MI6. And the man whom I mentioned earlier, who was an old, very old friend of mine, and to whom I gave this information from Terestchenko, and had this wonderful success with dealing with German double agents. He arrived in some time, I should think, in the middle of 1941. In other words, the same. He probably arrived 6 months later than I did. I arrived in January, early January 41. He had arrived sometime in the middle of 41, and had this spectacular success. And he was the head of Section 5. And that fact made a great deal of difference. I mean, here was a man whom I had known since, we'd known each other in the country since we were teenagers. And I think I'd known him also to some extent in the city. He was a banker in the city when I was a lawyer. And I'm sure, as sure as I can be, the fact that he was the man in that position made it possible for me to get MI5 and MI6 to cough up this information, which was about the enemy were doing far worse things in Portugal than I'd ever contemplated. And and then, of course, as I said before, the North African landings in November 42, following on the invasion of the Soviet Union and Pearl Harbor, which brought in the two superpowers on our side, made all the difference to a little country like Portugal. Seeing that it was now at least possible, and even probable, that we should be on the winning side.
So there was no question that the SIS people thought that what you were doing in Portugal would in any way cause problems for their own work.
That is something which is inevitable, because I'm. SOE's job is to do something physical and violent and dangerous to the enemy, and causes a stir-up, which is the last thing that the SIS want. And they want to plant a mole, maybe, who in 20 years' time will produce a vital piece of information. The last thing they want is to have some infernal SOE, whatever it's called. And even if it's under the same ministry, which of course Anthony Eden always was. Anthony Eden was one of our worst enemies. I probably had as good a relationship with my SIS opposite numbers as anybody in a similar position. By the sheer good luck that an old friend was sent out in this into this vital job.
You were talking earlier on about this Kazaish. How did you contact him?
It was a two-stage affair. I mentioned earlier about SOE people from Yugoslavia being ordered, when they were finally released, to take on various jobs in the area that I was in, such as Tangier. One of them, Sandy Glenn, was ordered to come to Lisbon and work with me, which he did for about 3 months. And his experience in Yugoslavia was very useful to me, because he'd been in a country for SOE at the time when it was actually invaded, and exactly what I'd been sent to Lisbon to do. Though, of course, it was a much more difficult country than Yugoslavia, which is so mountainous. He was working with me, and I don't think it was the result of any initiative on his part. It was I think it was accidental, but Kazaish somehow, and he got to know Kazaish, and to his tremendous surprise, he was asked whether whether the British could help him in the way that I described, by providing communications and equipment and so on, which of course he told me, and I told London, and then there came. I was very glad, you see, that somebody other than myself should tackle what was really a contact with the Portuguese government. I didn't want to give away the fact that I was the man at the embassy who did these sort of things. And I knew that Sandy was only going to be there temporarily. And so I was distressed when he got orders from London to go back to London. Because he'd also, in the past, he'd been some sort of Arctic explorer, and he was wanted some job in the Arctic.
Did you ever actually meet Salazar?
Yeah.
What impression of the regime in Portugal did you get whilst you were there? Did it seem oppressive?
There is no doubt, to my mind, that it is that a dictatorship, however benevolent, is a bad thing. He couldn't have been more benevolent. He was a philosopher. What else was he? A historian, an educationist, a sound finance man. But he was following a totalitarian course, which resulted in his having a secret police, who were really impregnable, and were above the law. And he often didn't know what they were doing. I certainly used to say that must be the case, because he is basically a decent man, and it is believed in London that he is. If he isn't on our side, he's certainly anti-Nazi. And this, I think, was and is universally accepted. And I was rather sad when he was overthrown, but I knew that it had got to come sooner or later. I should like to add that obviously I was unusually fortunate in my relations with SIS in Lisbon. The good fortune depended on a man coming out there whom I had known since he and I were teenagers. in the same part of England. Relations in London and elsewhere were usually a very different affair. Two matters occur to me as worth recording. The former partner of whom I spoke earlier told me at a very early stage that he did not think that MI6 could be a good organization because a relative of his, of whom he had a low character as regards intelligence, was the chief administrative officer.